justice-seeking and loving congregation. It is good to see all of you here. I haven't been in the sanctuary in a month because I didn't work last weekend, and then, of course, the 2 weekends before, we were all on Zoom or, you know, living in freezing houses without electricity. So it is so good to see people here, and it has been a delight to be in the spring after all that winter. So welcome to everybody, to those people who are online and have just joined us. And I just want to say that you are all really welcome here. You're welcome no matter who you are, where you come from. You're welcome no matter how you feel today, if this is your first time here, or if you've been coming for decades. Everyone is welcome here, as you are beloved children of the universe. I'd like to say that if you're a visitor, to please fill out the visitor forms that are in the seat in front of you. That's the way you can get our e-blast and find out all the ways to be involved with our community. If we will have coffee downstairs after service so people can get to know each other, and there's also coffee online, and the link to that Zoom room is in your order of service this morning. And I would like to introduce Karen Stratton, who's going to speak to us about stewardship.
Well, thanks, Tracy. I'm on, okay? Am I on? It's green. Okay, can you hear me? Thank you. All right, well, you already heard my name's Karen Stratton, and I am part of the stewardship team this year. And if you're new here, you may not be familiar with the concept of stewardship in a UU fellowship. At WOOF, stewardship is about generosity, taking care of what we value, and enabling it to grow. And last week, if you were here or online, I was online, and really, no. Yeah, it's green. People said they could hear me. Yeah, okay. Anyway, last week we heard from the visioning team about what people at WOOF value, and I thought it was an impressive list of things that ring true for me personally. Community, connection, opportunities for service and leadership, and then acting on our shared values. And being part of the visioning process made me feel like this is my place and you are my people. And I'm committed to taking care of what we value and helping WOOF to grow and flourish. The visioning process also led us to think about what we would like to change or improve at WOOF. And that can be a daunting process because we're all, by definition, individuals, and then we're Unitarian Universalist individuals, and we have limited time, energy, and money. But some of the major learnings for me from the visioning process was that there are others who, like me, want to improve our building and grounds in significant ways and find ways to do more of what we already do, like offer personal, intellectual, spiritual growth opportunities for ourselves and for our kids, and to offer a welcome to those newcomers who come in the door every single week here. And I'm so happy to always see new people looking for what we have here, hopefully. And I want to serve our wider community more effectively, too. So I mentioned that stewardship is about taking care of what we value and enabling it to grow. And when we become stewards here at WOOF, we take responsibility, contribute our time, talent, and treasure. This just popped in my head and is not in the script, but one thing that stuck with me is, like, it's time to take off the bib and put on the apron, right? You know, it's like we come here and we need to be fed because we're looking for something and we need that support and holding. And then we get to the point where we become stewards and we become the people who put on the apron or put on the hard hat and do the work that needs to be done to make the congregation continue to grow. So anyway, that's what stewardship's all about. But this time of year, like February of every year, it's about time, talent, treasure, but really treasure. This is the money time of year. And that's, you know, that is what the mission of the stewardship team is, to help bring the money in that we will need for the following year. We do that by making pledges, and this will all be done in 6 weeks, and then you won't hear about it again for another year unless you don't get your pledge in 6 weeks, and then you keep hearing about it. Anyway, our theme is transformation through generosity. And I really liked that whole transformation idea from the visioning. And, of course, generosity makes us feel better, makes the congregation grow. That beautiful graphic was designed by our very own Eleanor Claggett. So if you see her, give her the kudos for that. Anyway, we hope to transform WOOF into the vision that we are beginning to dream of. And we know that visions don't come true by wishing, so our transformation requires our generosity. The big deal is February 25th, we are going to have a kickoff lunch for everyone who is invited, who is here that day. Please join us downstairs. We are going to break up into small groups and talk about what's been exciting us about WOOF and our own visions and have lunch and celebrate, because that's what we're going to do as a community. Thank you very much.
You may now greet each other. And, you know, you don't need to have big conversations here. That's for coffee hour. Just say hello. Welcome. 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 Let us stay standing, and we're going to sing 1010. We give thanks.
Oh, we give thanks for this precious day, for all gathered here and those far away, for this time we share with love and care. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day. Oh, we give thanks for this precious day. Enough.
So I would like to invite Gil up to light our chalice this morning. And these are words are from the Reverend Sharon Lawal. Out of the flames of fear, we rise with courage of our deepest convictions to stand for justice, inclusion, and peace. Let us say our affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful and what is wondrous. Let us open our eyes to learn what is true and what is mysterious. Let us open our hearts to love one another and our neighbors. We will now sing, "When Will the Fighting Cease?" It's something unfamiliar to us. And if you'd like to open your hymnals, your teal hymnals, to 1025, you can see the music and the words. And we will, so sing along as you can or enjoy as you can.
Months ago, when I was serving as lay leader, I did something like, at my age, waking up every day is a reason for gratitude. And indeed it is, especially on a day like this. It's a beautiful day. We are here together. And that's one of my big gratitudes, is that we get to be here together. This is the time in our service when we think about gratitude and giving and how that is one big circle. We give because we can and because we must. We are here together in this community, and we are grateful. And if you have something particularly that you want to be grateful for this morning and would like to shout it out, please do. And grateful that we are here in this place and not in other places in the world where we might not be able to gather this way. So, as we receive your offerings this morning, think about what it is that you might have to give. Not necessarily money, but your talent, your time. What do you offer? What do you receive? We have buildings and grounds that take a lot of care, and we have wonderful people that show up to do that. We serve coffee on Sunday mornings and group soup once a month, and we have wonderful people that make that possible. So whatever it is that you have to give, think about that now as we listen to Betsy, who always provides us with some very contemplative music. And we gratefully receive your offerings, if the hosts will come forward. Thank you all for your generous offerings this morning. We receive them in deep gratitude. Now let us speak together our affirmation of gratitude and giving. Let us be grateful when we are able to give, for many do not have that privilege. Let us be grateful for all those who share their gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful even for our needs, so that we may learn from the generosity of others.
Now is our time for all ages, so if any children would like to come forward, you are certainly welcome to. You're also welcome to stay in your seats. Our story this morning is called Yaffa and Fatima, Shalom, Shalom. In a beautiful land called the Land of Milk and Honey, there lived two neighbors. One was named Yaffa and the other was named Fatima. Yaffa and Fatima each owned a beautiful date grove. During the week, they both worked very hard gathering their dates. On most days, Yaffa and Fatima sold their dates at the market and were able to buy plenty of tasty food to eat, which they often shared. Yaffa prayed at the synagogue. Fatima prayed at the mosque. They both loved God, and they both loved to follow God's way. Yaffa would read from her siddur in the morning. Fatima would read from her Quran in the morning. Yaffa fasted on Yom Kippur. Fatima fasted during Ramadan. Fatima celebrated Eid. Yaffa celebrated Passover. When Yaffa saw Fatima, she would wave, Shalom, peace. When Fatima saw Yaffa, she would wave and call, Shalom, peace. One year there was very little rain. Fatima and Yaffa had very few dates to eat or sell at the market. Fatima lay awake at night. She was worried. Perhaps Yaffa didn't have enough to eat today, thought Fatima. Fatima placed a basket of dates on her donkey. Then she took them to Yaffa's house. She poured the dates into a basket on Yaffa's porch. Meanwhile, Yaffa collected a basket of dates, placed it on her donkey, and carried it to Fatima's house. She poured the dates into a basket on Fatima's porch. the two neighbors quietly made their way back home, feeling happy. In the morning, when Yaffa walked onto her porch, to her great surprise, she saw her basket full of dates. "Goodness, I have so many dates. I will take more to Fatima tonight." Meanwhile, Fatima walked out onto her porch and was just as surprised. "Goodness, I have more dates than I thought. I will take more to Yaffa tonight." That night, Yaffa and Fatima loaded their donkeys with dates and set off towards each other's homes. They met just where their fields came together. Fatima looked at Yaffa. Yaffa looked at Fatima. The two friends hugged each other and laughed. "Shalom," said Yaffa. "Shalom," said Fatima. "Thank you for thinking of me," said Yaffa. "Thank you for thinking of me," said Fatima. Together they returned to Yaffa's house to share a meal of dates and tea. And one thing that's nice to know about this story is this story, versions of this story are told both in Jewish culture and in Arabic culture, a similar story. So we will now sing our children to their classes. Now is a time we often have prayer, meditation, and reflection, but for reasons that will be clear, we are moving that to the end of the sermon this morning. So now we will move to our joys and our sorrows. This bowl represents our community and the care and interest that it shows everyone who comes here and people outside of our walls. Today I place a stone for Lorraine Heller, a longtime beloved member who passed away this week. I also put a stone of joy for children's laughter and a stone of sorrow for children's suffering. And I place a stone for the people of Gaza. And a stone for the people of Israel. Because like Yaffa and Fatima, I think many just want to love their neighbors and live in peace. And now is a time that you can come forward with your own joys and your own sorrows and place a stone for each one in the water. We will hold your joys in celebration. And we will hold your sorrows in beloved community. If you wish to speak a word about your joy and sorrow or a sentence, I will have the mic. If you would just like to place a stone in silence, that is fine as well. So we will have a moment of silence, and as Betsy begins to play, do come forward. And one last stone for everything that remains in our hearts and minds. We will now sing Danu Nani Naish, 1032. The words are on the screen. Don't know.
We have two readings this morning that precede our sermon. The first comes from Anwar Jayose, a Palestinian man who is the CEO of a nonprofit organization providing funding to small entrepreneurs all over the world, especially women. He offers us two simple statements for our consideration. Fear makes us brutal to each other. And we are the victims of the victims who suffered the Holocaust. The second are words from the late American poet William Stafford, a lifelong pacifist. It's titled, For the Unknown Enemy. This monument is for the unknown good in our enemies. Like a picture, their life began to appear. They gathered at home in the evening and sang. Above their fields, they saw a new sky. A holiday came, and they carried the baby to the park for a party. Sunlight surrounded them. Here we glimpse what our minds long turned away from. The great mutual blindness darkened that sunlight in the park. And the sky that was new, and the holidays. This monument says that one afternoon we stood here letting a part of our minds escape. They came back, but different. Enemy, this monument is for you.
Gaza is small. We know that. But it can be hard sometimes to imagine just how small. So imagine this. Driving from Wilsonville to Vancouver, Washington. That is the length of Gaza. Imagine driving from downtown Beaverton to downtown Portland. That is the width of Gaza. Now, scoop up all the people who live in Monmouth County, Washington County, Clackamas County, and Clark County, and put them in that tiny strip of land. And that is the density of Gaza. 15 wars have been fought on that tiny strip of land since 1947. Since 2000, wars and battles have been fought there every 3 or 4 years, killing between hundreds to thousands of people, mostly civilians, each time. In 2007, the Israelis placed a complete blockade around Gaza after the hard right-wing party of Hamas took power. It has stopped the flow of people and of trade. Since then, most people have lived in severe extreme poverty. Most survive on humanitarian aid. As part of the research for this sermon, I watched the movie Gaza, filmed in 2018. In it, people, mostly children and youth, express their dreams of open borders and what then they could do with their lives. Own a fishing boat! One 14-year-old boy wanted, study international politics, said a high school girl. Find a job that would say, pay the bills, shared a taxi driver. Everyone dreamed of freedom, looking to the sea. They also, in the movie, reflected on the pain of the 2014 war that was not so far past, and they were all still recovering from. In that war, 30% of the people fled their homes, and 2,000 people died. A parent cried, regretting their choice to bring their children into such a war-torn land. A man showed the filmmakers the rubble of apartments where he had lived before 2014. In some ways, watching this film was like watching a horror movie. They all dreamed of lasting peace someday, but I knew what was coming for them. 26,000 civilians have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. More civilian deaths than all the other wars held there combined. 64% of Gazans have lost a family member. Another 70,000 have been injured, and more are missing. We don't even know how many more are missing, assumed to be crushed in the rubble. In the rubble of half the buildings in Gaza have been destroyed. Crops and farmland have been ruined. 80%, and now they're saying 90% of Gazans have fled their homes. Hospitals and schools have been destroyed. Just another one last night, killing children again. And over 10,000 children have died. And even more are on their own, orphaned or separated from their parents. People are starving. Most eat no more than a meal a day and spend hours in line for food that is often gone before they reach the front. They are drinking contaminated water or seawater. Infectious diseases are moving like quick-moving fire through refugee camps where people are so crowded they cannot sleep lying down, where there is open sewage and no way to clean anything. Many have no shelter in the winter weather and rain. And aid barely trickles in. On December 11th, the leaders of the 6 largest aid organizations in the world wrote an editorial to the New York Times that said this was the worst humanitarian crisis they had ever seen, ever. And they have seen a lot. With constant bombing and aid stopped at the borders, they said their job was impossible. They warned of devastation and death. How is this even real? That is the cry of my heart. How is this real? How can people, just people, do this to each other? How could the Hamas fighters kill so many innocent people so horrifically? How could they do it, knowing who Netanyahu is and his likely response, and how it would hurt the very people they supposedly wanted the best for? How can Israel ruin the land of 2 million innocent people? And basically, at this point, shrug it off? Or pretend it isn't happening as those people begin to starve and die of exposure and disease. Fear makes us brutal to each other, Anwar Josi told the New York Times recently as he sat with a reporter watching coverage of Gaza under siege on his television. And that is the truth. Fear makes us brutal to each other. The leaders of Hamas have declared that they will not stop attacking until Israel is destroyed. The leaders of Israel have declared they will not stop until Hamas is destroyed. Neither of the radical leaders on either side seem particularly concerned about the 2 million people or the hostages who are being destroyed by their rage of fear, revenge, and control. On May 14, 1948, the Jewish people danced in the streets, celebrating the establishment with Israel. You can watch videos of it. It is true, pure joy. And the Israelis celebrate this day every year. And on the next day, May 15th, the Palestinians commemorate Nakba Day, a day of mourning for great losses of 1948, when most of them became refugees. This opposite experience of that same moment is the absolute foundation of everything that happens in Palestine and Israel today. Late in the 19th century, Jewish people persecuted in Europe began to create a plan to return to the Holy Land, a beautiful dream, an understandable dream. Then after World War II, the world community, guilt-ridden and sickened by the Holocaust, supported their plan. The land of Palestine was then under British control, and the UN suggested dividing that land into two states, one for Jewish people and one for native Palestinians. The plan gave the new Jewish state 52% of the land and most of the farmland. But at that time, the Jewish people only owned 6% of the land and were just a quarter of the population. The Palestinians, fairly understandably, did not agree with the plan. So a civil war began. This is what the Palestinians call Nakba, the Great Catastrophe. And the Jewish side had a better army, and they were better financed. They massacred Arab settlements in ways that sound indistinguishable to me from the October 7 attacks. They made the Palestinians leave major cities at gunpoint. The Arabs were marched away holding almost nothing. 750,000 Palestinians, or half the Arab population, were forced to flee, and they were never allowed to return. Israel bombed 400 Palestinian villages until they were rubble. In the film 1948 about the Nakba, an elderly Israeli man who had been a young soldier during the Nakba, described standing at a checkpoint as the crowds of Palestinians came through, holding just a few things, sometimes without shoes, carrying children, often injured. And he recognized in that moment that this is just exactly what had happened to his people in Europe. And he felt sick. He said all the Jewish fighters at his post felt sick. But then soon, a ship came with refugees from Auschwitz who filled the homes and businesses left by the Palestinians. And that was good, giving homes to those who had suffered so horrifically. Pain causes pain, causes pain, causes pain. The Palestinians have never stopped fighting for the land and places that were once theirs. They have not conceded. They have been occupied. And Israel has never stopped protecting the land they believe is rightfully theirs and have desperately needed after the atrocities of centuries ending in the Holocaust. And both sides are understandably terrified of each other because each side has shown that at any moment, without provocation, they will kill. Leaders have turned each other into monsters, not people. An Israeli official has called Hamas human animals. And beginning on October 7th, we have watched up close and personal what 75 years of nonstop fear, anger, violence, and trauma allows people to do to each other. We have watched what happens when people tell the story that the only way to be safe is absolute control or annihilation of their enemy. It allows each side to justify anything, like the killing of 10,000 children who just happened to be in the way. The panic of people who professionally deal with hunger and famine and disaster across the world is growing daily. As of a few days ago, most of Gaza was in the emergency stage in food crisis lingo, emergency phase, and that means that most people are eating far too little and everyone is always hungry. But the prediction is now, in February, Gaza will move to the catastrophic phase, in food crisis lingo, which means most people aren't eating at all. And what do people in the United States want to talk about? Is Israel justified doing this? Was Hamas's attack also justifiable and understandable? Oh, should we call this genocide or should we not call it genocide? Is the idea of a free Palestine irresponsible? Is it anti-Semitic to accuse Israel of wrongdoing? And honestly, a week and a half ago, I planned to tackle some of those issues today. I know a lot about this anti-Semitic argument. I've read a lot. But really, literally, I almost cannot handle it anymore. The articles, the podcasts, the opinion pieces that are righteous or defensive or all-knowing, it just sounds like so much noise from people who are not eating grass and drinking seawater and holding their children who are now too weak or sick to play. Because there is only one right thing here. There's only one right thing. That the fighting must stop now. That the world must be planes and boats and trucks of food and shelter and medical supplies. That people must come who know how to start the healing of deeply, deeply shocked and traumatized people. Morally, this is absolutely the only right thing. And this could be done. It's not money or capacity or any logistics that stop us from doing this. Humans can be remarkable to each other. They can. And I suspect aid could be on the way in a few hours if everybody decided they wanted that. But people who are making the decisions don't want that. They are too busy worrying about who is right and wrong and who is good and bad and whether they'll be safe or not safe. While shooting or selling weapons, fear makes us brutal to each other, says Anwar Jawasi. So how does this stop? I don't know. I don't know. Fear and rage is pointing those weapons. And every explosion and every bullet and every death grows that fear and that rage. How do traumatized, frightened people get to, as the poet Naomi Shihab Nye says, a place in my brain where hate won't grow? I think about how hard it is to live in a place in my brain, where hate won't grow, in my own privileged, peaceful life. When I've been hurt, betrayed, humiliated, or lied about, my first reaction is nearly always rage. I know just what it feels like to want to hurt somebody who has hurt me. But I've chosen, because of my Unitarian Universalist faith, to do everything that I can to live in a place in my brain where hate won't grow. I want that. I want to act for the well-being of others. I want the actions of love to be my response to the world that I live in. And I know that sometimes not hating can be really, really hard. And I can't imagine, literally can't imagine, the rage and the fear and the hurt inside the Israeli and Palestinian peoples. No one in my family died or was persecuted in the Holocaust. No one in my family was removed at gunpoint from a village that they had lived in for centuries. My spouse was not pulled from a bombed building. I can't imagine what those things do to your heart and your soul and your spirit. And so I can't judge those feelings, and I understand how violence can explode. But we all watch that the plausible genocide, as the International Court of Justice called it a week ago. And I agree with the poet. We all have to learn how to get over it. And that is the only way peace will ever come to any of us. Humans need to learn to help people heal from the traumas that lead to hate and violence. We need new stories that we tell each other about how to create peace. The conservative radicals in charge of the Israeli government and Hamas both believe that control through violence is the only way that their people will ever be safe. They believe this, even though the last 75 years of trying this strategy over and over has offered no safety to anyone. It has utterly failed. And the past 4 months make that crystal clear. Still, Netanyahu's government is determined to follow the path to its extreme end. No one can say what the Israeli end game is. Netanyahu says, when Gaza is no longer a threat, whatever that means. But yesterday, they began bombing Rafah, the city where nearly all 2 million Gazan people are now huddled in misery. And they are ignoring all international cries for more aid to the people. So we might imagine what the end game is. The current Israeli government and Hamas will not change their approach on their own. I'm not sure they're capable. But they must be stopped. And the American people, that's us, have the power to stop this. And I mean that absolutely seriously. In every Israeli-Palestinian conflict up to this one, the violence only ended when a superpower told Israel to stop. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, that has been us. It's important to remember that it is our country, the United States, that funds that war and supplies those weapons that are destroying Gaza. That's us, our country. The U.S. supports Israel for many reasons, a presence in the oil-producing Middle East, as well as extremely strong weapon and pro-Israel lobbies, who lobby people on both sides of the aisle effectively. However, enough American voters can overcome the influence of big lobbies that benefit from the situation in Israel. And already the pressure is rising on the government to change. A couple of days ago, a small group of senators, a very small group, wrote to the Biden administration to demand a ceasefire. 2 days ago, 800 officials from Europe, governmental officials from Europe and the U.S. asked their governments to change course. Their letter read in part, "Our government's current policies weaken their moral standing and undermine their ability to stand up for freedom, justice, and human rights globally." It adds, that there is a plausible risk that our government's policies are contributing to grave violations of international humanitarian law, war crimes, and even ethnic cleansing or genocide. So if you've been here a long time, you know I'm not a minister who tells people what to do. I'm more of a, here are some things you might want to consider kind of minister. But today, I want to say that we all really need to add our voices to that growing pressure on Biden and Congress to stop this now. We need to ask every person we know to do the same. The Gazan people are starving and dying of disease and are being bombed in their final sanctuary now, today. So we have to put as much pressure as we can on the U.S. government to insist on an immediate ceasefire, to insist that the Israeli government allow humanitarian aid into the country. There's only about 100 trucks of aid crossing the border right now from the 500 trucks that were passing in the pre-war times. And we have to insist that the U.S. aid to Gaza be reinstated and increase it. So last week, the day after the International Court said there was plausible genocide in Gaza and ordered Israel to ensure more aid to civilians, Israel accused the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees of being infiltrated by Hamas operatives. They wanted it shut down, they said. The U.S. and other countries responded by cutting aid to the agency. And most aid agencies say these are the people that know how to get aid into Gaza and work with people. Them not having money is basically an end to most aid. And we also must insist on the return of the hostages to Israel. And so I am asking you to call and email the president and every one of your representatives. We have letters downstairs that you can just sign and mail. They're written out to most of our representatives already. There's also some sheets on more information where you can donate money, other places with actions you can take, and more information and addresses for your representatives. And the pressure really has to be intense, or they really don't listen. So call every day if you can. Mail letters often. Ask your friends and families to join you. Because this is an actual emergency right now. If one of us was unhoused or didn't have enough food, most of us would help them without question. And this is in the moment to extend that kind of love and care to the people of Gaza, who are just people. They're just people, just like us. I believe one of the most important tasks for human communities is to learn how not to hate and to come into those places where we want and even work for the well-being of others, like the two women in this morning's story. This can be exceptionally difficult. I do not underestimate that. But the consequences of not learning this are horrific, as we can so plainly see. And I believe this is one of the tasks of our faith as Unitarian Universalists, to keep learning how to love, because it is only truly when we care about each other and act truly for the well-being of ourselves and others that peace is possible. I ask that we, all of us, keep practicing these skills together. So I'm going to conclude our time with a prayer from the Contemplative Justice magazine, Gies. And then we're just going to stay seated and start singing the song from Emblem of Revolution, Peace, Shalom, Shalom. And we will carry the frame, and I will go to the door But if you have some questions for me about what I've said, we don't have time for questions in the service. I'll be available for about 15 minutes right after, maybe 5 minutes after the service in here. So if you want to stay, I'll be free, happy to answer questions for you. So here, a prayer. Take a deep breath. A prayer for Palestine. We weep. We scream. We listen. We pray. We pour into the streets. We make phone calls. We boycott. We divest. Yet it does not feel like enough, as people are being turned to rubble, as the blood of children seeps into the soil below. Even the stones cry out. We pause to breathe. We choose quiet to tend to one another so we can hear the still, small voices, so we can hear your rustling amidst all the noise. O Spirit, who pours over all of us, who moves in the wind and rests on the rubble, O Spirit, who never abandons us in our tears, who strengthens our cries and joins in the drumbeat on the streets. O Spirit, who knows each bird in Gaza, who dances through those beloved streets and has played in the hearts of each child. We come to you now, begging, pleading, wailing, for the end of genocide, the end of apartheid, the end of bombings, the end of children being murdered, and for our Arab and Jewish kin to know deep and lasting healing. Rest upon us now as we pour out our rage, our grief, our exhaustion, our confusion, our fears. Remind us to breathe, to be still, to listen, to feel our bodies on the land, and to be forever altered. Summon our courage, our fierce love, our reliance on community, and our imaginations. May there be a turning in each of us and in the world. May the fire of justice rise from the belly of the earth. May the bombing cease. May liberation come now and always. Amen. Stand in the front, may face the back. from the back to forward, and let us sing together, Carry the Flame.